Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jaakko Hamman, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, The Millennial Narrative, Sharing a Good Life with the Next Generation. Jaakko, thanks for being willing to do another interview with me.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Appreciate that.
Millennials have been a hot topic for some time. The lives of these folks, whom you define as having been born between 1980 and 2000, have been subjected to extraordinary scrutiny. They've been represented from anywhere from the next greatest generation to the most self-absorbed generation yet and everywhere in between. So what brings you to write about millennials now?
Chris, correct. Yeah, millennial folk, I've come to believe have received a raw deal in how other generations have evaluated them, because they are the largest generation we have at the moment in the U.S. They are, and will determine, but I think they are doing that already, actually. They are determining our future in significant ways. And when older generations look at this generation, it's often with a very critical eye. So in my research over the years, I've grown into a space of saying, wait a minute, there's more about this generation than just a very critical look at them. And to tell this generation that they are too narcissistic, for instance, or, you know, that they are killing some kind of an industry. They are killing the car industry because they Uber and Lyft and they don't buy cars anymore. And I think this is a fascinating generation. And personally, I think my hope for a sustained future is not in my generation. I'm a Gen Xer, and it's certainly not in the late boomers. My hope for a sustainable future is actually in the millennial generation. I think they are the ones who's going to help us make some turns that we need to take.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle of your book, Sharing a Good Life with the Next Generation, suggests, at least to me, an audience and a goal. You want folks who aren't millennials to find ways to live meaningfully with millennials. Actually, your audience could be seen as being even more focused. You're speaking specifically to church leaders, and you're calling on them to be effective, or what you say, what you call significant leaders rather than dominant leaders. So what do you mean by significant and dominant leaders, and how and why are millennials pushing the church and society more generally toward different leadership models?
So one of the key traits that we find in the millennial generation is they do alternative communities well. Mm. So that translates into them not going to church anymore. And we know about 70%+ of millennials do not attend church, will not go to church, or traditional places of worship, if we can call it that. So a dominant pastor or leader would say, you have to come to church, you know, you are missing out on something that you need, and we can provide it for you. That would be dominant. A significant leader, I think, is somebody who recognizes that the millennial generation, they are doing something special in the world already, and how can you partner with this generation and maybe even allow this generation to teach you something new about a vocation such as leadership that you think you know well, or a tradition such as Christianity that you think you know well. Maybe we can discover something new if we partner with the millennial generation, because they are active in the world. We know that from many kinds of studies, that they are active in changing the world in really positive ways, ways that incorporate social justice, care for the earth, ways that I think especially faith communities can learn from.
And at some point I will get beyond your title, but I keep asking, I have more questions about your portions of your title. So use the term good life. So what is What is the good life? I mean, what are you thinking about when you talk about the good life?
So the good life, you know, traditional faith communities would argue that they are the carriers, the ambassadors, the embodiment of good news. And then the good news literally will be, you are a sinner in need of salvation. This is how you are saved. And then once you are saved through the person of Jesus, then come to church. That would be the good news, the traditional good news. We know from research that the millennial generation does not have an ear to hear that. Rather, I think they are interested in the good life. And traditional faith communities have been very poor at best at helping people find a good life. So what is a good life? I argue, because I draw on the biblical prophet Joel quite a bit, I argue that a good life is to embrace, mourn, and sort of engage the losses, the crises, the traumas that you have in life. That's where the good life begins. It kind of begins in loss, in a sense. But then the good life includes being embedded into life-giving communities, friendships, other communities, relationships. It implies discovering God as gracious and compassionate, and a God who instills a life force in you that both restores the crises and the traumas that you've experienced, but also empowers you to make a difference in the world. I think a good life implies accountability or a sense of responsibility. And there we know millennials are really strong on that, calling us to task in terms of just our relationship with the earth, for instance. Accountability. And then the last one, I think a good life speaks to making a difference in the world, contributing to society, caring for the younger generation or a different generation, even if you go to the older generations, you know, tending to the earth, cultivating a sense of wholeness for people, or in more traditional language, can you be a blessing to other people? And I think if you live a life of mourning your losses and your traumas, building community, discovering the compassionate God, being accountable, and you make a difference in the world, that is the good life that you then live.
And wrapping, in some ways, wrapping all of these things is the idea of a narrative. I mean, the narrative is extremely central to what you're what you're doing in the book. So what do you mean by narrative? What is a narrative, and why is that important? Why are narratives important?
Well, I can answer that from a few sides. The one is sort of just in terms of how we make meaning in life is typically by being able to find ourselves into something bigger, into a larger narrative of sorts. And our neurology, our minds work according to story. That's why when we were babies, we read children's stories. And as a young child, you never tire. You can listen to the same story like 1,000 times. But you find something new in it. And I remember when I read those stories to my girls, they would know verbatim the story that I'm reading to them. Because we've read it so many times. But the power of a story is that it invites you into a plot where there are, you know, protagonists and other folk that you can identify with. And it takes you on an emotional journey of sorts. And I think we were created, and certainly our minds work that way, seeking these bigger narratives, these stories that we can live into. Douglas Rushkoff, has a media theorist, has a wonderful quote that I paraphrase as he says, many people... he paraphrases this way, that people live according to, or need to live according to an act, a play with many acts, and then he says, most people live by hit singles. Because in the age of technology, you live, say, in a Twitterverse, mm-hmm. or, you know, what's driving Instagram today? And you just go from moment to moment, and you don't have those overarching stories mm-hmm. that we live by. When we go to traditional cultures, such as Aboriginal cultures, or Native cultures, or Khoisan cultures in Africa, we again find the importance of story, mm-hmm. of narrative, and how they live by these big stories. Mm-hmm. So I'm arguing in my book that the millennial generation have lost those big mm-hmm. overarching narratives, because that's what tradition typically would give you. And in their case, tradition has not developed that kind of a presence. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so narrative is really important for us, whether it's for our dream world. We always dream stories. Mm-hmm. Because that's how our brains actually function. And can you really live the good life without being able to put yourself into a larger narrative? Mm-hmm. If the only narrative you have is you? Mm. I doubt that, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned Twitter, and I learned the other day about this new thing called TikTok, which was fascinating. It's these, you know, sort of random videos that don't have any stories. And I mean, in some ways, to me, they kind of fit into what, you know, some people characterize as sort of a postmodern period that we're kind of living in. So I mean, is this, in some ways, you're kind of speaking an alternate way of addressing this kind of situation, or how?
Well, kind of yes and no.
Yeah.
So in the postmodern paradigm, we would argue that there is no meta-narrative.
Yeah.
There is no big story. There is no good news. Mm-hmm. You're a sinner in need of salvation. Here's the salvation. Right. There is no that, okay? But within narrative, mm-hmm. we move away from this meta-story that is true for everybody, but it gives you the potential to appropriate the story on a personal level. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the postmodern step too, is to embrace the relational component and to invite a person to find themselves in the story. So if I say that the good life begins with loss, mm-hmm. you and I will talk differently about that loss. Mm-hmm. And I cannot even come in and say exactly for you how that loss would be. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee you there's loss in your life, because that's a pretty universal dynamic. So I think it's a little bit, I would agree with you that it's maybe a little challenge to postmodernism if postmodernism is perceived as just all these free-floating narratives. And everybody can just pick and choose.
Fragments, even.
It's just exactly, a very fragmented life, even. Mm. And I argue that, but that's not the way we live, actually. Mm-hmm. And we don't, if we go the fragmented life, the language that tradition would have is that everything is relative. Mm. But it's not relative. It's always relational. Mm. Because I'm not relative, and you are not relative. But I have a different relationship to the losses of my life than you may have. Mm. And so it's always relational. And I think that's what millennials teach us as well, because they are so strong on building alternative communities, that the relational component for them is always there. The relationship is there between them and their tattoo, for instance. The cover of my book is an arm with a tattoo. Mm-hmm. And as I've engaged many, many a millennial, there is no tattoo that does not have significant relational and spiritual meaning. Mm-hmm. And of course, the older generations just look at a tattoo and think, but how can you be a professional, you know, if you have a tattoo? But I think that is a pretty antiquated kind of way of looking at things, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've already mentioned, actually briefly, the fact that you're interacting with Joel. You talk about a trialogue that you're working with, millennials, narratives, and Joel. Yeah. So why did you pick Joel? What is Joel? So for those who aren't familiar.
It happened in a weird way, Chris, and that is for many, many years, basically the last 20-odd years, whenever I had to go and speak to communities that I do not know, I would tell them the story that we find in Joel. And that story basically says...
Which is a book in the Hebrew Bible.
It's a book in the Hebrew Bible. It's a neglected book. It's all of 73 verses long. But it is rarely read and preached about in church or in faith communities, where I would argue it's probably the most important book for our time at the moment. But it's a story that begins with locusts that devour an agricultural people. The prophet comes in and says, gather, come together. Joel then brings in this very compassionate God who's gracious and slow in anger and abounding in love. I think is the kind of God that everybody wants to believe in if they want to believe in a God. Mm. It's a kind and gracious God. This God comes and instills God's life force. The translations typically say spirit, God's spirit, but it really is God's life force that's active in all of us. And then this God holds us accountable, and the book ends with an image of water flowing as a sign of blessing. So can you bless what's out there in some way? And so having traveled with Joel for many, many years, but in different kinds of contexts actually, it suddenly dawned upon me that the main foci of Joel that I just mentioned coincides with core aspects of millennial life, which is they know loss and trauma intimately, they build community, they are deeply spiritual people. Mm-hmm. Even though they do not attend traditional worship settings, they are deeply spiritual, they appreciate accountability, and they want to make a difference in this world. And so the foci of the book of Joel, if we go with Rushkoff's idea of a play with many acts, the six acts of Joel actually overlap in a weird way with the millennial experience. And so here we have a story that on at the youngest we would say 2,500 years old. At the top level, we will say 3,000 years old, but a very ancient story that suddenly resonates deeply with the current generation.
So you've kind of laid out how the book works. You go through each of these acts, and we're going to just touch on each chapter and leave it to the listener to read the book to get the details. And each chapter essentially has a similar kind of structure. You do a reading of a section of Joel. You talk about a theme, the central theme that you find in it. You co-write a section. I'll have a question about that a little later. You co-write a section with a millennial whose life and work exemplifies the theme. And then you provide five practices around this theme for significant leaders. So let's begin with lament, which is where the narrative begins. What kind of experiences are millennials facing that make lament particularly salient to them? Because we all have difficult experiences. So what's particularly salient about this for millennials, and what does Joel provide that helps both them and significant leaders?
Yeah. So the good life begins with loss, as the narrative of Joel begins with locusts that devour the landscape. And the Hebrew text is actually much more nuanced than the locust. Four kinds of critters are identified. Two of them are actually caterpillars or worms, and then two of them would be grasshoppers locust. But Joel actually wants to say that two kinds of crisis comes into our world. There's the slow-moving crisis that will catch up with you, but it's slowly evolving over time. And then there's the fast-moving crisis that comes in and surprises you. And I think today's young people are exposed to those kinds of crises in a way that previous generations may have been protected from a little bit. Mm. If we just think, for instance, of the financial crisis of 2008 and how many people lost their homes, that would be a very fast-moving crisis. Nobody saw that coming.
Mm-hmm.
But then also in looking at research where the pressure for young folk to be whatever you want to be, which is not possible because you can only be what your gifts allow, what your opportunities present you. You cannot be what you want to be.
Mm.
And so I think young people today just know loss intimately. I'm thinking of working with a youth group up in Michigan, and we had a whiteboard, and these folk were basically at the very bottom end of the millennial generation. So they were teenagers and early 20s in age. And I asked to name the losses that they've experienced.
Mm.
And just about every person there have experienced suicide already.
Mm.
Where a friend have committed suicide or attempted suicide. And I'm thinking, God, how old was I?
Mm.
You know, before suicide became part of my life experience. And I was way into adulthood.
Mm.
And here you have young folk who know that well. You know, they would describe the challenge of losing homes and living with a divorced mom and dad and going back and forth and all kinds of traumas. You know, date rape. We know that one in three ladies will experience date rape.
Mm.
So the crisis and the trauma can be actually pretty pronounced and quite serious for this generation. So to begin with, loss is a wonderful way to also to sort of to equalize everybody, because everybody knows loss. And the locusts of life have touched every life out there. And it's just an entrance into vulnerability. And today's young people are pretty open with the crises that have touched them, the struggles they've had. And so yeah, the young folk today, the millennial generation, do not shy away from the locusts. Mm. I think we previous generations want to walk away from the locusts as fast as they can. This generation is actually walking towards their losses in creative kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. And they're gathering, not necessarily in churches, as you said, but a lot of them aren't. And you also note, or you consider in some ways that millennials are the priests of our time. I mean, if you could, I would like you to say what you mean by that. But if millennials are finding meaning in these non-church gatherings, and if they're in fact priests of a sort, what about Christianity would be particularly compelling to them?
Yeah, absolutely. So exactly. So Joel is what's called a demanding prophet. He has 43 demands in 73 verses. One of the demands that he give people is to gather.
Mm.
And that's his response to the locusts of life. When the locusts come in, you gather, you surround yourself with people. And millennials are masters at creating alternative communities. And as we've said, away from traditional faith communities. Mm-hmm. So in the average church, there'll be few millennials in that church or in the average faith community. And so what makes gathering so compelling for millennials, I think, is that they know intuitively that loss isolates and loss pushes you to the fringe of experience. And by gathering with people, you are held in relationships that is life-giving. Now, Christianity, I think, have missed out a little bit on huge opportunities, because these young folk often gather around food.
Mm.
The Dinner Party, one of the groups that I write about in my book, is a fast-growing community where if you've experienced a death, you come together, eat a potluck meal, and it's not quite a grief group, but it's kind of like a grief group. Mm-hmm. And you can share how loss touched your life and how you are impacted by this loss. Now, of course, churches have been eating together forever. And a good question can be asked is, how come faith communities have not created spaces for people where they can lament some of the losses that they've had? I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, as church communities are aging and lots of people are retiring, like every church should have a retirement group where people can help each other out. How do you retire well?
Right.
Just how do you navigate all the loss and the changes?
All the people that you know that are dying.
Exactly. Exactly. As you age.
Yeah.
You know, my mom is 90, and in speaking with her just the other day, where yet another funeral, you know, that she couldn't even attend because the funeral was in another town. And she said, you know, all the trees are falling. But nobody's really coming around my mom necessarily, and that she's in a pretty conservative Christian community. So I think what millennials are doing is they are challenging Christianity to say, if you are a community of love, which I think a lot of Christian communities will say they are, then live into it. Live into it, and live into it tangibly in a way that creates space for people to mourn and grieve, to find themselves again after a loss. And so at the moment, I almost would say there's not a lot of incentive for millennials to go to faith communities.
Yeah.
Because I think faith communities still hold on to the good news when the good life has been totally neglected by these communities.
Right. So, and these millennials, you say, are priests. What is, what?
Yeah. So if you think of the priests of the Hebrew Bible in the ancient Near East, the priests were the folk who basically navigated rituals for the people of God.
Right.
And so I'm saying that there are many, many millennial folk who are curating, facilitating, making possible these rituals for community building, deep intimacy, finding purpose and meaning. One of the millennials that I co-wrote about, Julian Gillette, a phenomenal young man who does recipe exchanges, and he will invite people to say, give me your best recipe for an entree or dessert or maybe an appetizer. And people come together, prepare meals, eat it together, but share the significance of the recipe. Who gave you this recipe? Why is this recipe important to you? And immediately people are transported into significant relationships with moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas and aunts and uncles. But it's significant relationships that is now part of the conversation. And so I think millennial folk are sort of the priests of the day because they help facilitate the rituals that give purpose and meaning in people's lives.
And so you have the losses and the gathering, and you also have God, a particular God with particular characteristics that becomes part of this narrative, a compassionate and restorative God, as you've mentioned. Some folks argue that millennials have what they consider problematic views of God. One pair of scholars designate millennial attitudes toward God with the term moralistic therapeutic deism. you're saying it along with me. This is a two-part question. In what ways do you disagree but also agree with these characterizations? And this might be the more complicated question. To the extent that millennials' views of God, which may be less compassionate and restorative than what you find in Joel, to the extent that those views come from other parts of the Bible, how does a significant leader handle sort of some of the hermeneutical difficulties that might come up when people are saying, well, yeah, Joel is compassionate, you know, God is compassionate and restorative, but somewhere else, God is whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. So
I guess, how do you agree and disagree with some of the scholars' less positive views of millennials? And then what about these hermeneutical questions?
So in sort of a modernist view, I would be able to say that I can bring God to you, mm-hmm. and I can tell you exactly who God is, mm-hmm. and God is A, B, C, and D. Mm-hmm. And I can point to all those places in Scripture where God punished people and killed people. Right. And I can do all of those things. If we go to a more of a narrative approach, I have to say, here are pictures of God. Mm. Which of these pictures resonate with you? And I'm thinking the picture of God today that resonates with young people especially, mm-hmm. is the picture of the compassionate God. Mm-hmm. And yes, the dominant leader may say, but wait a minute, you know, there are other... But I think that leader kind of forgets that people have to discover God. I cannot give God to you. Mm-hmm. You have to discover God. And then, for me, it was kind of important to recognize that millennial generation, they do things differently in many ways. But the book of Joel, who brings this compassionate God, who Phyllis Trible would say is womish, because compassion in Hebrew has the connotation of womb. Mm. Rachum and Rechem, they all are tied to womb. This womish God. Joel is a different kind of prophet too, in that Joel, the only prophet who's not really interested in personal sin for that matter, and is definitely not into a retributive kind of a theology that God punishes you by sending locusts or something like that. Mm-hmm. And what I would argue is that we have to recognize the very diverse images of God in Scripture, mm-hmm. and that we have to allow people to find an image of God that is meaningful to mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And then I think... most people that I have met, at least in life, including myself, I would much rather discover the compassionate God as some God who just keeps tabs on all your evil deeds and who's out to punish you at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, who wants to believe in that kind of God? I certainly don't want to believe in that kind of God.
So then what you mentioned this moralistic, therapeutic deism.
Yeah. So I think what happens is that when folk who are very close to traditional understandings of God, mm-hmm. that often focuses on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, because you're a sinner in need of salvation, when people come from a very traditional understanding of God and they evaluate young adults who basically create a belief system for themselves, that evaluation is almost extremely negative. And in moralistic therapeutic deism, that kind of language basically says, well, people cannot choose their own kind of God, and they cannot construct meaning for themselves. They have to find the meaning that tradition gives them. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something deeply problematic about that. Mm-hmm. You know, even tradition is, in this sense, is... selective mm-hmm. at best. It's a certain kind of tradition that is presented, when actually there are many traditions out there. Mm-hmm. And why this one and not that one, mm-hmm. for instance? So yeah, a very highly critical evaluation that traditional Christianity often have towards the faith and life experience and spirituality of young adults. Mm-hmm.
You use the word spirituality, which is a perfect segue to my
to
my question about your next act. There's been a lot of discussion in certain circles about the whole concept of spiritual but not religious, and spirituality is considered to be lesser than the religious. So How is Joel related to that conversation?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So Joel comes and says, God, this compassionate God, notices the devastation that the locusts have caused. God will repay you for those damages, those losses. But part of the repayment or the restoration, really, is God's life force that's poured out over young and old, over men and women, and over free and enslaved. So the God of Joel breaks through sort of like gender, ageism, classism. That God breaks barriers. And I see that is really what millennials are teaching us big time, is that these very deep barriers and boundaries and binaries that tradition has set up, nothing of that holds any anymore. So that's the God that Joel introduces to us. And then I fully embrace the research and the work of sociologist of religion, Nancy Ammerman, who basically challenges us and says, you know, this language of spiritual but not religious, that doesn't hold up in today's world anymore. People are deeply spiritual and in their homes, far removed from faith communities, they engage in religious practices. They pray, they have little altars in their home, they go on pilgrimages to experience something of the divine. They commune with nature, things like that. And I agree with her. I don't think we can hold on to the distinction or to the construct of spiritual but not religious anymore. I think people are deeply spiritual, especially millennials, and they are also religious, even if they do that far removed from traditional practices of religion.
So far, just to recap, where we've been. So we have a movement from loss and trauma to a gathering and community to a discovery of the compassionate God who pours out God's spirit or life force the spirit or life force is there. And then, as you note, the book of Joel also has something to say about the day of the Lord, which can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on who you are. So you use the concept of accountability to understand the day of the Lord in Joel. So what is accountability? And you've already kind of suggested how millennials sort of fit into that, but if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so in the prophetic tradition of the Old Testament especially, the day of the Lord is a very powerful theme. It's this one day where God will be the judge and people will be judged. And especially Israel will be judged for its misgivings and its sinful ways of this group of people. And I reframe that in the book of Joel by saying that, and I follow some really good scholars in that, it's not just me doing this, but I say that the day of the Lord can be seen as a day of accountability. And in the book of Joel, the accountability that God actually is holding us to would be at the level of social justice. It's about boys and girls who were taken into slavery and into prostitution. Basically, God says, I'm going to hold you accountable for human trafficking. This is not an accountability for personal sin. This is an accountability for sort of social and political evils. And the book of Joel has this beautiful two parts. The first part is very personal sort of at the the personal and societal level, in a sense. The second half of Joel speaks very much to the political side of things. And can we have a just society? And so by reframing the day of the Lord into a day of accountability, I recognize that millennial folk do not have this very traditional understanding of sin and a punishing God. But I also think it is actually what Joel offers us, is a God who's just going to hold us accountable for our deeds and what we do. Mm-hmm. I imagine that I'm going to get some pushback from moving away from the day of the Lord as something that has to be feared, because in Joel, those folk who have met the compassionate God and who now lives with God's Spirit within them need not fear the day of accountability. Mm. It's actually the people who are engaged in trafficking and in thefts or fraud or things like they should fear. Mm. But it's not the people who have met this gracious God. Mm-hmm. And I want to hold on to that image. I think that's a beautiful image for today.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, at the end of the book, we have, you already mentioned, flowing water, all kinds of flowing liquid.
Yeah.
an image of restoration, for some anyway, because Egypt and Edom aren't so lucky. So what do we do with the fact that some are, and in some ways your previous response may answer this, what do we do with the fact that some are restored and some become desolate?
Yeah.
And in some ways, when I got to the end, I was thinking about this narrative as not a straight line narrative, but almost a cyclical kind of narrative. I was thinking about Ecclesiastes, you know, a time to be born and a time to die.
Absolutely.
So do you have any sort of reflections?
Yeah, so the ancient Near people, the people of the ancient Near East, they believe that if you're a king, you have to live next to a river. Mm-hmm. Kings live next to rivers. And of course, they all had kings and they all had deities that they could physically see and touch, which they then placed next to rivers. And then here comes the God of Israel, who cannot be seen, who is not the typical God. And so Israel took that over and brought into their narrative that water flows from God's throne. It's sometimes said from God's temple. And it actually permeates scripture. From the rivers of Eden can be perceived as that way. And Revelation 21, the very last chapter of the Bible, starts off with this image of water clear as crystal flowing from God's throne. It actually permeates scripture, but it's also in Joel. And so what Joel basically says is that God's blessings wants to flow to parched lands. Mm. To lives that's devastated and destroyed, and gives new life, wants to give new life to those people. But then you are right. If you were caught in, if your accountability showed that you are engaged in acts of social injustice, for instance, then God's blessing is not going to flow to you. Mm. And so the book ends with the blessing of life, really, that flows to some people, but not to others. Mm. And there's a little bit of irony in the book of Joel, in that people who lived by the coast suddenly will find themselves in deserts, and people who were desert people will suddenly find themselves by water. And so it sort of kind of communicates that there will be total disruption for these people who live unjust lives. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful image for me to say that, you know, you who have been touched by the locus of life, because you're in community, because you've been restored by God, you can be a blessing to other people. Mm. And that's what I see over and over again in millennial folk. Even here at Vanderbilt Divinity School, our students are actively involved in this city of Nashville, making a difference. Mm-hmm. And I see that is the real gifts and strengths that millennial generation brings for us.
And some of those students who aren't, I don't think any of them is a student here anymore. But actually co-wrote some of the sections in these six-act chapters.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? Why did you do that kind of strategy? Did it end up affecting the individual writing that you did in the rest of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So remember I said that I think a significant leader is somebody who can partner with and join what millennials are already doing in the world.
Yeah.
And so it was really important to me that in writing the book, I want to model that partnership. Can I learn from young people, even though I'm 20 years into my career as an academic? Can I learn from people who are still busy getting their Masters of Divinity degree? And so I invited, for every chapter, I invited a diverse group of beautiful young people in to teach me something about how they work towards this changed world, but also how they are deeply spiritual, how they travel with a compassionate God. And what I would do is I would write the sort of the sections of Joel and some of the ways that I would perceive leaders should be different in their leadership. And then I would send that off to the student, and then they would sort of critique what I have written, but also write their piece. And then after they have given their piece, I would go back and basically rewrite my chapter on the sections that I have written, send it to my millennial co-author to basically approve what we have what we have co-written.
So in some ways, the whole book is co-writing.
it absolutely is true. And not just that. So here was six young folk who intimately worked with me on every chapter. But I had a group of about 25 millennials, a larger group, who read every chapter, who gave me some of my case studies, who criticized my language, who helped me give shape to this project by saying, what you state here does not resonate with me one bit. Or they would say, you know, this is really good. I can find myself in what you write. So I had about 25 plus, about 30 in the end, 31 plus millennials working carefully with me on that. But then I also had folk who were Gen X and who were late boomers, some pastors, some therapists, counselor type folk who read every draft with me of every chapter and would give me feedback on just how do you hear Joel, and does this connection that I make between the millennial life and experience and the book of Joel, does that make sense to you? Can you see the connections? Was it just me, you know? And so it was really helpful to have a whole cohort of people, all in all about 40 people, who read everything that I wrote as I was doing that, one chapter at a time, you know.
So you've recently done a book on technology, and now you have a book on millennials. What's next?
So I'm working on two projects at the moment. The one is actually on leadership, and especially business leadership. And I'm co-authoring that with a person in the business school, a colleague, Derek Anderson, who teaches in the business school here. And he is a vice president of Monroe Carroll Hospital, the children's hospital here at Vanderbilt. And then I'm working on a second book, which I'm very excited about as well. And that is, the working title is Pastoral Virtues for Artificial Intelligence. So I'm going back to technology. And I'm asking the question, how can we help technology to be mindful of matters of intersectionality, for instance? How can we help AI to be patient and kind and gracious rather than just being pretty masculine in its thinking? AI at the moment, always for productivity and cost production and reduction and things like that. And certainly we want an AI that's more human. In the sense, so in my first book on technology, I argued that the question about technology is really not about technology, it's about human nature. What does it mean to be human? And now I'm actually turning the question around a bit, and I'm saying that if we are going to be totally determined by technology, how can we have artificial intelligence be more human? And that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Great. Well, I look forward to future conversations.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you. Thanks for your kindness.
Thanks again for this conversation. Again, I've been talking with Jaakko Haman, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, The Millennial Narrative, Sharing a Good Life with the Next Generation, published by Abingdon Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.